SpongeBob, Homer Simpson, Fred Flintstone. Do you ever get the feeling our popular culture isn't exactly furnishing good role models for boys? Wait, we haven't even mentioned the music scene. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. This week on The Spirit of Things, we're asking the question, how do boys become men?
I'd like to find that long-lost map. That map that should have been when I hit puberty, they should hand it to me. Since the first day, I've been looking for that map. I'm hoping that I can find someone who can help me and send me in the right direction. I wish that, you know, I'd grown up with a male in the house other than myself. Someone to even out the numbers, someone to be a man, you know, be a guy. So you can hang out and do guy stuff. So they can hang out and do girl stuff.
That's from the film Boys to Men by my guest today, Frederick Marks. You're tuned to Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Frederick Marks shot to fame with his documentary film Hoop Dreams in 1994, which won the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. It's about African-American high school kids whose lives changed when they became part of an elite basketball team. That began Frederick's interest in the welfare of teenage boys. 10 years later, he made Boys to Men. New American Heroes is the sequel. He was in Australia recently as a mentor in the Mankind Project, which focuses on the emotional needs of men and helps them become mentors for boys. Later in the program, I'll be talking to Paul Henley about Pathways Foundation, which focuses on young teens. The key mechanism in all these programs is the rites of passage. Frederick Marks joined me in Sydney. Frederick Marks, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
It's good to be talking to you. And I have to say, the first thing I notice is your sheriff's badge, which says change agent. And I, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I discovered these at a conference of some colleagues called Social Ventures Network. And there's a nonprofit company in Portland, Oregon that makes them. And they promote them as a way of having people literally use as an emblem, an outer emblem, to demonstrate to the rest of the world that they're actually interested and in fact, creating positive social change. So I actually wear it quite proudly. I mean, I think it fits with my jeans jacket, but I also like to pin it on interns who graduate and move on from my nonprofit film production company as a way of recognizing their willingness to step outside their own sort of ego identification issues and take a stand for service to the greater community.
Well, your films have been about trying to change the world, haven't they? I mean, you're here in Australia promoting the film Journey from Zanskar, which is a really touching film about a couple of monks who take some children across the Himalayas on a perilous journey. It's about the fate of children, and that's something you're really passionate about.
I am. I guess I'm as passionate about it as a man can be who doesn't have any of his own. You know, it's funny. I tell people all the time I consider myself an expert on these issues because, in fact, I don't have any. I'm an expert as only one who isn't there on the front lines every day experiencing the contradictions and all of the complexities of raising a child can be. But yes, you know, I am really concerned about children's welfare, but not only. In a sense, you could say that most of my work, I'm interested in all of the underdog stories in the world, and they take so many different forms, you know, all of the oppressed, as it were. My company mission is very simple because I can't remember it otherwise. It's bearing witness, creating change. It's four words. So the bearing witness part is simple, is telling stories, you know, rooted in documentary reality and creating change. It's using those stories to create some kind of positive social change.
But the name of your company is Warrior Films, and that's immediately about men being warriors, and that also has an expression through your other work, which you do with young boys. Your films have also been about young boys. Hoop Dreams, Boys to Men, ? Why have you been focused particularly on boys?
You know, the easiest and simplest answer is that, you know, when I was 9 years old, my father died very suddenly, had a heart attack, was here in my life forever, seemingly one day, and then gone forever the very next without a goodbye. So, you know, ever since that moment, I've sort of struggled to understand what it is to be a man in this world. My uncle, on our way to the funeral, put his hand on my shoulder and he said, you know, Freddie, you're the man of the house now, at 9 years old. And to me, this is emblematic of the kind of dysfunctional culture that we have around masculinity, that somehow a 9-year-old boy should be in any way tasked with being a father to a family that he's only a child of. So that began this journey for me, no question. But it was interesting for me because I realized the other side of that. Now that I'm a mid-50s-year-old man, you know, 10 years ago when I was making the film Boys to Men, I discovered that part of the appeal for me was not so much in working with teens in order to rediscover, in a sense, my own lost male identity from my teen years, but in fact, to express in a positive way my own fathering energy, which I actually have in, I wouldn't say great abundance, but I certainly have plenty of. And since I don't have my own children, I need a productive place to put it. So I put it into my films, you know, and I put it into the very intimate relationships that I create with the families that I film in my stories. And I also put it into my mentorship. You know, it's very important to me to be mentoring young people. There's no better way to heal yourself if you're an unmentored young man than to step into mentorship yourself.
Where did you find that kind of mentorship at the age of 9?
I suppose you could argue that there were plenty of opportunities around me in family relationships and the like, but the fact is, if they were there, I rejected them largely out of hand. The truth about me is that all through my teen years and all through my 20s as well, I rejected any male, any strong male figure who sort of appeared on my horizon. And in fact, I gravitated more toward relationships with women and gay men. And it's interesting, you know, it was only in my 40s that I began to understand why that occurred. And I think it had to do with the fact that I felt like my emotional life was safer, in a sense, in the hands of women and gay men than it was in strong, tough, sort of macho men. But I also recognized that at some level that I projected the worst, most fearsome aspects of my Germanic father onto these other strong men, and that was part of the reason why I pushed them away.
In America today, how many young men are without father figures?
Oh my gosh. Well, I think there's something like half of the young men growing up in America today either don't have fathers in the home or they don't have a father figure, as it were. It's harder to define, of course, father figure. That can be quite broad. It can be a coach or an uncle or whatever. But, you know, for me, this is one of the primary causes for so much of the social dysfunction that we see across the planet.
But young people invariably look to some kind of leadership, and that would probably be in the popular culture, in bands, in rock bands, and in films. What sort of an impact do you think that's having?
Oh, huge, huge. There's no question. And you know, the simple truth is, you know, as elders in the society, if we don't take the responsibility to initiate our young people into mature masculinity, they're certainly not going to be able to cobble it together from popular cultural influences. You know, we still have, and these are extremes, but on one hand, we still have, you know, the popular sort of macho male myth. And on the other hand, we sort of seem to have, you know, the Homer Simpson model from the Simpsons cartoon. I don't know how it's happened exactly, but over the last 20 years, fathers have suddenly come to be seen as the buffoons of the family, as the figures who can't do anything, who don't know anything, and are complete idiots, not only in a sort of an emotional sense, but in any kind of sort of practical sense. So that seems to be sort of the scope of the images that are offered our young people. Obviously, there's others, you know, through music in particular. But it's really, really difficult in a post-feminist society for a young man to sort of decide, well, how do I become that man that I want to be in my life? And if they're just left to popular culture, the chances are not good they're going to find it.
Well, how much has feminism, in fact, altered the ideal man? I mean, in Australia, for example, we have the notion of the sensitive New Age guy, the snag, which happens to also be the name for Frankfurters or, you know, sausages on the Barbie. But, you know, that has certainly undergone some change.
Well, you know, yeah, and I think young boys, at least in the United States, they know that they're supposed to be sensitive. They know they're supposed to be emotionally vulnerable. But nobody is really teaching them the skills to do this, giving them the tools to both access and identify clearly what these emotional states are, and then to use them in a productive way that will serve their lives for the better. And that's just one skill set, is the emotional one. I mean, there's integrity and accountability. My belief is that all men aspire to being in integrity, to being accountable, to being, in a sense, to use Joseph Campbell's term, the hero of their own lives. But we don't give them the tools. We don't educate them in how to do this.
But isn't that what religious traditions have always tried to do? They have set up the ideals for the good man, the holy man, the pious man, the community leader. They've done this through rituals such as in the Jewish tradition, the bar mitzvah, in the Christian tradition, confirmation, or in other Protestant traditions, declaring your faith in Christ and your commitment to the community. Isn't this where religious traditions came into their own in a young person's life and now perhaps not nearly as often, not nearly as much?
Well, yeah, you know, I think the religious traditions and certainly all of the indigenous cultures across the planet, I think, are the fountains, the source fountains of this knowledge about initiating young people. You know, there's an African proverb that says, if we do not initiate the young, they will burn down the village to feel the heat. And in fact, you know, that is, I think, a lot of what we're experiencing around the world now with our young people. But what's happened in the modern age is that so many of these wonderfully rich and powerful traditions have been corrupted by consumer ideology, by the worldwide consumer fever, you know. So even, you know, a rich and wonderful tradition like bar mitzvah practice, you know, when I was a young man and I would talk with all of my friends who were being bar mitzvahed, the conversation would begin and end with, what did you get? You know, it was all about the money you received, the gifts, etc. And so the real ritual intent of creating a threshold that was a real trial for a young man to cross in order to deserve that recognition as a man was not happening. There wasn't enough of a trial, in effect. And so part of what I want to focus on in my next film are rabbis who are actually doing bar mitzvah practice, but with what I would consider to be a richer, truer initiatory intent.
Is there actually a movement that is kind of reclaiming the bar mitzvah tradition back to its original intent?
Well, I think there is, but I'm not, you know, familiar and schooled enough in it to know for sure. But put it this way, I think there is a worldwide movement to reinvigorate rites of passages, and it's happening across cultures. And it's also happening in a modern sort of new age way, if you will, through the non-sectarian weekend workshops. You know, these can also be quite productive means of initiating our young people. And in fact, here in Australia, there's a wonderful group called Pathways, and they do initiations for both boys and girls, pathways to manhood, pathways to womanhood.
Well, I understand you've also been in Australia with the Mankind Project. Is that your organization?
No, it's not. No, it's an organization that was founded in 1985 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by three men who came together and recognized that, you know, in a sense, they were jealous of what they experienced had happened for women in the post-feminist age.
You mean like consciousness-raising groups?
Exactly. Support groups for women. And they thought, you know what, we need these for men. And they didn't realize exactly what a deep nerve they struck and how absolutely essential that would be in the coming years. But they started a weekend workshop that originally, I believe, was called the Wild Man Weekend. Cut to 26 years later, and this weekend workshop has spread to 15 or more countries. There's over 50,000 men around the world who've done it, myself included. I did it in 1995 in Chicago. And it's here in Australia. It's been here in Australia for 10 years.
That's Frederick Mark speaking there about Mankind Project, which I must say has some mixed reviews. Some people think it has cultish aspects, and others don't. Go to our website for further information. That's at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Boys to men, not an easy transition these days, especially as there are fewer mentors for young men to look up to. And that's what the people in today's Spirit of Things are trying to remedy. Later we'll hear about Pathways Foundation. So without the week-by-week attendance at church, which is what used to provide that kind of modeling, I asked Frederick about the workshop.
What does it take to go from a boy to a man?
Well, if you do a weekend workshop, does it really stick? I mean, has that weekend in Chicago in 1995 remained imprinted in your mind?
Absolutely. It has. But the way that it's remained imprinted in my mind, the way, in fact, that it's completely informed and reshaped my entire life is through the follow-up work. And the follow-up work is what we call I-groups, but they're really men's support groups. So men sit in circles in somebody's living room once a week for 3 hours a night, usually on a weekday evening, and they support each other. They talk about the emotional struggles that they're facing in life, their trials with family, their trials with work, whatever it is. And the men collectively support the man to reform himself. You know, it's not about, okay, we're going to pick up some bats together and go beat up on the guy who's causing you trouble. What can you do to make yourself a better man so that this issue is not in your way? So that's what we focus on.
Sounds like the resources then come more from the realm of psychology than, say, religious traditions, or is it a combination?
Well, it's actually a combination, and we've borrowed liberally from other traditions. I mean, a lot of our sort of overarching ideology is actually a neo-Jungian psychology. So Robert Moore is one of the fathers of this kind of thinking from Chicago in the United States. Archetypal energies, you know, which is sourced in Jungian psychology, but he's refashioned it and is really sort of the intellectual father, if you will, of the men's movement. So we use that, but we've been gifted for our weekend by a Native American elder with a Native American tradition, which is the sweat lodge ceremony. So we utilize that as well on our weekends. We don't do it exactly like the Lakota people have done it for centuries, but it's a kind of a modified version. So we incorporate ritual into the sort of the psychological support mechanisms that we incorporate on our weekly meetings. And together, the two, I think, are very, very powerful, because ritual is absolutely essential too. I mean, in a modern environment, I think it's so vital that we reclaim our capacity to create ritual. It brings the sacredness back to each individual moment. And that's something that, given the kind of consumer economy that we all inhabit, consumer culture, is more essential now than ever.
It's interesting, because when I look back when you were young and people were looking at their inherited traditions, they would often dismiss them as just empty ritual. Funny now that the importance of ritual as a transforming experience is being rediscovered.
Yeah, well, and it's no truer than in my own personal life. I mean, my parents, even though they were both 100% Jewish, they were both atheists. So I was never bar mitzvahed, and I was never raised, you know, as a religious Jew. So for me, you know, I was always extremely averse to the notion of religion in general, but certainly religious ceremony or ritual. And, you know, it was only really late in my 30s, but really into my 40s, having done this weekend, that I began to sort of resurrect the importance of ritual in my own life. And now, you know, I'm a completely different person. I mean, I could talk about this issue for a long time, but let me just say one thing. I'm going to give you one small example. 4 or 5 years ago, there was a dear friend of mine who went through that very same weekend in 1995. And in one of our first I groups, he said to us, "I have cancer. I don't know how long I have. You guys are going to have to bury me. And you guys are going to have to be the ones to support my son when I'm gone and my wife." So cut to 10 years later, I'm working on a project in Iran, and I get an email from his I group from Chicago. They say, "Marty's now been diagnosed stage 4. We don't think he has long. Can you join us for an event to celebrate his life in Chicago, such and such a time?" Fortunately, I could. I came back to the States. My wife and I flew to Chicago. I walked into a room in our men's lodge, as we call it, 100 or more people in the room. Marty was sitting at the front with his son and his wife by his side. Person after person in that room got up and said, quite movingly, "This is how you've impacted my life. This is the difference you have made, Marty. Thank you. God bless you." And I did it too. Of course, I had tears streaming down my face at the time, but it was an absolutely beautiful ceremony. So for me, this is one example of the kind of ritual I think we need to re-bring back to our daily lives. My sense is that nobody should leave the planet with anything less. Meaning, if you know that somebody is going to be dying sometime soon, get your family together, get your friends together, get their colleagues together, and have an honoring ceremony for this person. Nobody should leave the planet with anything less, because a funeral is too late. They're in the ground, they're gone. Tell them while they're still here.
Gosh, what sort of an impact did that have on Marty?
Well, I kidded him in the months afterwards because he lived for another year. And I think that
it probably gave him more strength.
Exactly. That's my guess, is it actually gave him more strength to carry on. He lived for another year. So, and by the way, I also pointed out to him that as I looked around that room, that we weren't all there from that original I group of 10 years earlier, but three of us were there. Three of those men were there. And that means a lot. And that's the kind of bonding and the kind of community that we've built through this, we call it an initiation process, even though it's just a weekend workshop.
It certainly sounds like it can be the start of something big.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have the audacity to call them initiations. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, there's a kind of a philosophical difference that I have in a slight way with Michael Mead, who's also one of the grandfathers, if you will, of our men's movement in the United States. And he says that an initiation, it can't be created, in a sense, consciously by the community. That maybe that's being unfair. Maybe for him it's both and, meaning that yes, you can do that, but you can also be initiated through some pressure cooker experience that you have in life that, in a sense, creates that cauldron that you pass through and become a transformed new man on the other side of.
That's sort of crucible. But on the other hand, you do have to have someone to talk to and to develop it into something meaningful, as opposed to just experiencing it and, you know, going home and thinking about what it might mean.
Well, and exact, and in fact, I would be completely remiss. I mean, all of the data supports the fact that you can have the peak experience of a lifetime on a weekend or whatever. It won't mean a damn thing unless it's followed up afterwards with regular, rigorous work. And part of the reason why we call these I groups is because of the word integration. We integrate all of the tools and lessons that we've learned on the weekend into our daily lives. So if you don't practice this stuff, it's just going to disappear. You just have this kind of fond little memory about, oh, yeah, I had a wonderful time then. That's not what we're interested in. We're interested in remaking ourselves as men to become the men we've always wanted to be in life.
And what does that mean in terms of the ideal image of that man? I would imagine, Frederick, that for, you know, 50 men in a room, there would be almost 50 different ideals of what a man should be.
Well, exactly. And it's not for me or anyone else to dictate to that man what his ideal of manhood should be. It's absolutely essential that each individual discover for themselves what their gifts are, to use the Native American term, and how to give those gifts to the community at large. Another way of saying that is to find out what your purpose is in life, what your mission is in life. It's absolutely essential. I mean, to me, this is the greatest crime of the last couple hundred years, is that we're bearing children on the planet in great, great numbers, but we're not giving them what is essential for their meaningful passage through this lifetime. And that is a sense of what they're here to do. What they're here to do, what their purpose in life is. And that's only something for them to discover, but they will discover it if we hold that crucible for them of a meaningful rite of passage. They'll find it.
So you're talking about also establishing certain structures in which young men can be fed through, as it were.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I mean, historically, in most indigenous, well, I'll make it a sort of a modern day context. So, nowadays, you know, when a teen starts acting out, particularly a teen boy, using drugs, drinking too much, beating up on little sister, stealing, sassing mom, whatever form it takes, these were the signs that the community would recognize in the days of old, and they would come, the elders would come and put their hands on that young man's shoulder and saying, it's your time. It's your time. That's all. Because this is the unconscious sign that the young man is giving to his family and the culture at large that now is his time. He needs to be taught how to become a man. And the fact is, what they're doing, like, for example, when they're doing drinking and doing drugs or driving 100 miles an hour down a city street or whatever crazy harebrained thing they may be doing, they're doing what is an essential element in initiation, in a sense, which is they're trying to experience the depth of their capacity as a human being. They're trying to know what the limits they have as a physical being. And they need to be taught this stuff. They need to be taught it, but they have to be taught it in a safe way.
And that brings up the whole business of rites of passage being only viable if the community actually recognizes the importance of it, and also, I would imagine, imposes some responsibility on the individuals who go through it.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. The initiates, you mean?
The initiates.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because at some level, what passes for the rituals into adulthood these days, they don't really have that component, which is, okay, yeah, now you're 18 or 16 or whatever, so you can drink legally, you can drive a car legally, you can do this, that, and the other, vote. So we give them the privileges, but nobody sort of gives them a handbook on responsibilities, you know? So here are the concomitant responsibilities that you have. And it has to do with integrity and accountability. It has to do with emotional facility and awareness. It has to do with mission, sense of purpose, knowing who you are on the planet and how you're going to serve your greater community, etc.
Again, that brings me back to religious traditions, which really are about teaching people the responsibilities they have to the community, whether it's the Ten Commandments or elaboration of those Ten Commandments. So I'm wondering whether the need for these workshops is an indication that the religious traditions have somehow failed.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, the power of consumer culture is endless. So we've all been impacted by it. I mean, it's not for me to judge, really, how much religious traditions have failed. You know, I would say this. I think it's important that if a young man or woman comes from a particular religious tradition, that their initiation be in that religious tradition. Because one of the essential lessons that comes from initiation is where you fit in the cosmos. You know, it's you have to understand the beautiful paradox of being absolutely insignificant on a speck of dust in the greater scheme of the whole universe, and at the same time have infinite capacity for power and change. That in other words, that the impact that you can have on the planet, on your community, is actually in effect endless. So there's that beautiful paradox that sort of lies at the center of just about any initiatory experience. And it's very, very helpful, I think, to have the spiritual or religious overlay of that for a young person to sort of understand him or herself in the context of that greater spiritual overlay. Now, if one is an atheist, for example, that's fine too. You can still have a similar experience, but you won't have the added gift, if you will, of that greater understanding.
That's the Oscar and Emmy nominee filmmaker Frederick Marx, whose documentary Journey from Zanskar was just shown in Australia. It's about two Buddhist monks who take 17 children across the Himalayas to a school that will change their lives. We are talking about Boys to Men on The Spirit of Things here on ABC Radio National, and how rites of passage are a key part of that process.
I'm mad about the boy, and I know it's stupid to be mad about the boy.
Frederick, you've pointed to the consumer culture as a barrier to really developing from boy to man. But there are other aspects in our culture that can prevent that too. The way we communicate to each other, the way we see each other. And I know that you've been in Australia for a while, and you've noticed something about the way men are referred to.
Well, I have. And it's sourced in some of the mentorship that I got post my weekend in Chicago in 1995. And it has to do with the pride that I've been taught to use the term men and to associate with that very simple term men. And actually, if you go online and you look at my trailer for my upcoming film, the very first words on the screen are, men are made, not born. Okay? So it's not just a gender issue. When you're born a boy, that is no guarantee you'll ever become a man in my book. So what I've been a little bit concerned about here in Australia is the cultural tendency for both men and women to refer to groups of men as boys. And I've said this a number of different times to waiters, waitresses, people that I've just run across in all kinds of circumstances across the country. They say, hey, boys, how you doing? And I just look at her and I say, men, please. And they're a bit taken aback, invariably. And I got into a very insightful conversation with a waitress in Perth who had never before had that brought to her attention. And I said to her, you know, when I was a young man, when I was a teen, growing up in the feminist era, I was very, very aware that I was not going to address any woman over the age of 18 as a girl. I was not going to do that because I was taught, and I believe it to this day to be true, that it's insulting. It's insulting. And I think the same is true for men. And believe me, I get it, and I understand that, you know, this is your Australian culture and these are your traditions, so it's very difficult and not usually advisable for an outsider to sort of comment on a cultural tradition, but I think it's noteworthy, and I think it's especially noteworthy in conjunction with the fact that I've experienced Australian women complaining about the maturity levels of men in Australian society. So if, in fact, you know, you're a woman out there, and I would suggest that you might want to stop referring to all of the men in your lives as boys. If nothing else, that will remind them of a standard that they should aspire to.
I agree, but I'm intrigued also by the way people sidestep that whole issue and call everyone guys. Hey, you guys over there. It doesn't matter how important they are, what age they are, what gender they are. It's a strange sort of way of avoiding the
whole issue. I agree, and I'm very uncomfortable to this day in referring to a group of women or girls as guys, which is, I see girls do that all the time. But I'm not as bothered by the term guys for men as I am boys, because guys does not indicate an age, whereas boy definitely does.
Now, can I ask you one thing about manhood? A lot of people think to be a man is to be heterosexual, and that the whole men ascription refers to a certain kind of man. How do you respond to that?
Well, it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. I mean, you know, one of the things that in the Mankind Project in our work that we're very, very conscious of are multicultural factors. And gender sexual preference is only one. So we're very, very welcoming and accepting of gay men in our work. They are absolutely men by any standard. But we're also increasingly aware of and accepting of cultural differences. I mean, as the work has spread across the world into 15 countries, you can only imagine the cultural complexities that we've run into. I mean, it's now in, you know, Germany, England, South Africa. As I said, it's in Australia. Soon will be possibly in Iran, India. There's going to be real cultural complexities that we have to navigate and negotiate. And we want very, very much for each culture to sort of take the work but translate it into its own form. So here in Australia, you know, the men are already doing that. They're taking what have been Americanisms, if you will, from this workshop, and they're making it truly Australian, which is as it should be.
Well, I, for one, am looking forward to meeting more and more people who are wearing that badge that you've got there called Change Agent. Maybe I can get one myself.
Well, you will, I promise you.
Frederick Marks, it's been great having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
And after I get that sheriff's badge from the award-winning filmmaker Frederick Marks, then I'll need a holster and then maybe a horse. I just might ride off into the sunset. But before I do, we have someone else to hear from, and that's Paul Henley. He's originally from the UK and has worked in Australia for 20 years in housing, youth, and family issues relating especially to boys. He's worked in restorative justice for New South Wales Juvenile Justice. In my earlier conversation with Frederick Marks, he mentioned an organization called Pathways. So I called up Paul, who was the co-founder of Pathways Foundation and who's now its national training manager. With the promise of a man. Paul, when did Pathways Foundation begin? What was its origins?
Its origins were back in the early 90s when a number of men around the country independently were doing work with boys. And then we met together in 96 and decided that the coincidence was too strong, and we felt as though it was a call by spirit, if you like, to come together and to start this work.
Why did you want to work with boys?
Well, look, originally, Rachel, my passion was working with young people. My history comes from working with young people both in Europe and in Australia. And at the time, I was working with men, looking at emotional issues around men. And one of the things that come from those groups was a real need for men to support and work with their sons. And from that work, really, Pathways was created.
Do you have a son? Were you working with a son?
No, in actual fact, I've got two daughters, but because I've worked with many boys, especially boys at risk over the years, I feel as though I've got many sons out there.
And from your experience, do you see a common trait in boys which is a warning signal to you?
Absolutely. I think we can look at the statistics around youth suicide and many of the other issues facing our youth today. And maybe I've got a little quote here that that relates to the sort of work that we have from an African teacher who suggests that civilization lacks rites of passage as a sick soul. You know, it is sick for three reasons. There are no elders, the young are violent, and the adults are bewildered. And for me, that sums up the sort of experiences that I was having as a worker with youth, where I was pulling youth off the street, taking the needles out of their arm, going back the next week, and the same people were there. And it was very frustrating to be able to keep on in that cycle.
And is it rites of passage that Pathways Foundation offers to young boys?
Absolutely. And it's not just to young boys. The rites of passage is really a map, from my perspective. And it's a map that our ancestors knew very well. And it was one of the most important ceremonies for any society. And can I suggest that it's just not a one-off event in the life? It's an ongoing process. There's many rites of passage, but one of the most important ones is for our adolescents, moving from boy to young man. And it's a threshold that has huge consequences if it's not done correctly.
Well, indeed, how does one do it correctly? Where do you draw your blueprint from, as it were?
Well, I mean, when we all first met, we were all quite inexperienced, and can I suggest that none of us were actually, if you like, initiated men. We all had to find this information and understanding from many of the writings of our ancestors. And we got a lot of information, and then we sat down and worked out what were the needs in a contemporary society and how can we change those real key elements in the rites of passage to support appropriately a modern society. And there's three elements when we started off, which was separation, challenge, and return. And these were the concepts that our ancestors used in all of their rites of passage. One of the things we didn't really understand at the time, there was a fourth element, and we took that fourth element for granted, and that was connection. So now we have four elements that we recognize very strongly in any rites of passage. Separation, which is really leaving everything behind, and it needs to be the iPods and the iPhones, all that electronic gear that all gets left behind, including maybe some of those business people's continuation of being connected to the outside world by telephone. We then have a connection, so we create community inside of that camp, and so the community itself starts to really form a support role. And then there's a challenge in all of us, in all of our lives. We have challenges, and certainly moving from boy to young man in itself is a challenge. So we create safe but solid challenges throughout the camp. Then, of course, there's the return. And the return is really about not just returning to community and returning to mother. It's also returning to self. And so there's a number of processes that we go through that allows that connection to happen, about returning to self and returning to community.
Well, I understand you just had a camp this past weekend. So did you journey through those four elements?
Absolutely. The camp program itself has been written, and we keep pretty well close to that. Of course, when you've got participants and their needs and their wants and individualities change the program somewhat, but pretty well we keep to that program. And the thing about the program itself, it's laid down like any rites of passage, like a map. So the ability to follow that program, and of course the greater number of its parts, creates something more. So we tap into those energetics, if you like, to make sure that those energetics advise us of where the program needs to go to support the individual people in that program.
Well, Paul, what sort of transitions have you seen happen in front of your eyes?
Well, look, the transitions in sometimes are quite dramatic when people suddenly have an epiphany. I wonder if I could just read you a couple of testimonials, particularly from mothers who have received back the father and the son. And this is from Marie. Bringing extended family was a very important part of this program for us. Grandmother never felt so special at the return day ceremony. I saw an immediate benefit for my husband, and feel my son has changed, even did his dirty washing when he got home from camp.
Right? Well, that's an improvement, isn't it?
Well, if that's just an indication of the sort of change that can happen. But it's not just those practical things. This journey is not just an external journey for boys and men. It's also an internal journey. And for many of the men and the boys that come to camp, they get an opportunity to talk about stories that they may have never heard before.
What are the sort of problems that they're struggling with? What do you think are the character traits that you see in boys that really need to be worked on?
Well, I think, and I think this is—it's not just an intellectual concept; it's a biological key. Each of our young people, whether they be boys or girls, have a biological key, and part of that biological key is separation. Now, if we don't organise a separation and support that separation from family, then what we get is dysfunctional behaviour in order for that separation to be created. And many of our parents coming along to the program are really at their wits' end understanding why their son, that a few years ago was a sweet angel, is now turned into this six-foot hulk that demands a situation that requires them to discipline or requires them to push them away. And in many ways, what the boys are looking for is they're looking for an unconscious separation. And what we suggest is that unless this rites of passage comes, then that relationship between boy and parents is going to get to a point where the boy forces separation. So what we hope is that during this process is that we go through a conscious way of that separation, allowing the boys to understand who they might be, to hear stories from men who have gone through that experience before, not just their father, but many of the men in the camp, so they become in many ways uncles for those boys. They get to hear those stories, they get to understand what their own unconscious process really is.
And what do the boys tell you, or the young men tell you, after they've been through one of these camps?
Well, here's a thing from Tom, who was a young boy on this particular camp we'd just come from. And his realization at the end of the camp was that this was a crucial experience for him. And he says, it allowed me to realize how important the transition to manhood really is. So I suppose what we're doing, Rachel, is we're bringing up a consciousness about this transition. And if this transition's done in a conscious and appropriate way, then the benefits are huge. It means that relationship is not something that young people move away from. It's actually something they walk towards.
Paul, can I ask you more specifically what happens at the camp? I mean, for example, how does it differ from, say, an adventure weekend for boys?
Well, look, an adventure weekend really is an external experience, and it's normally for the boy to have, and then he comes back to family. What this experience is a whole family experience, which the father is strongly involved, or father or mentor, or sometimes we have grandfathers coming with the boys. And so on the camp itself, there's lots of experiences where those relationships get deeper. Now, the difference between an external or an external process is that the boys, unconsciously to begin with, moving towards consciousness, start to have a realization of what it is to be a man, because what they've got in front of them is 30 or 40 men that are willing to be there for them to go through this process. So there's a huge reflection. And it's also part of the experience of the mother. You know, the mother needs to learn how to let go of the boy, allowing him to walk towards young man. And the mothers really need support in that process to happen. There's no longer a tribe of other women around them giving them support around that process. And so our female leaders offer that encouragement and work with the women while the father and son are on camp, so that when the boy returns, there's a new parenting situation being created. Because in many ways, rites of passage is the delivery tool. But in actual fact, this is a parenting education program. So it's a whole family experience. And so when the boy comes back into family, there's a range of knowledge that allows the whole family to move towards supporting that boy to walk towards manhood.
So how long is someone involved in Pathways, in the program?
The actual program itself, it really starts a few weeks beforehand when we have a meeting with the parents, and we call this the first night. So it's really the first night of the program. And it's just for parents, and we talk about some of the issues they may be having, some of the problems that they're facing with their young people, and we prepare them for the camp. A couple of weeks later, we have a leaving ceremony where the mothers and the fathers are involved, and we take the fathers and the boys off, leaving the mothers at the hall with the female leaders supporting them. We then go on camp, and of course, there's a 5-day camp completed by a return at the end. Then is a reunion at the end of that process, about 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, to bring that community which has been formed on that camp, and sometimes the relationships formed on that camp are lifelong relationships. Then we offer for the boys, and also for the girls, but for the boys, we often come back within 9 months. We use 9 months as a gestation period for their maturity to start to develop. We bring them back and offer them to come on staff as a returning young man. They get involved in a team and behind the scenes, and really they're the stepping stone between the boys and the leaders so that the boys feel more comfortable. Then many of our returning young men have been through a number of camps, and we offer them an opportunity to come back and join our leadership team, the young leaders. And they're mentored and supported through that. So how wonderful these days to be able to say that a boy that went through his rites of passage when he was 13 is now 20, and he's coming back and he's leading other men and boys through the same process.
Gosh, that sounds like a very good cycle to have got going. How many people have been through this workshop now?
Well, look, the workshop started back in 93, and we've probably gone through and had about 9,000 young people come through the program to this date. But it's a bit like a pebble into a pond. You know, if you throw a pebble into a pond, what it creates is ripples, and the effects go out. So many of those 9,000 boys have created ripples with their siblings, with their friends. You know, the families have been affected. We encourage grandfathers and grandmothers to be part of the process and honor them as elders. So that 9,000 multiplies out as the ripples from that initial pebble going into that pond.
Mm. And finally, what sort of traditions do you draw on in your practices and rituals?
We draw on many of the ancestors' rituals, many of the Aboriginal people of this land, you know, with permission, we've worked with them. So many of the ceremonies and parts of ceremonies they offer us allow us to ground into what's really experience of the natural world. And if I can quote something from one of your books, Curious Obsessions, the natural world, as much as the human world, is embedded with spiritual values. And again, so we tap into those spiritual values in the natural environment, allowing all those elements that maybe we know we don't know to support this wonderful experience of a boy moving from boy to young man.
Well, Paul Henley, thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things and shining a light into this obviously burgeoning new tradition that is helping boys to become men. And I understand also girls to become young women.
Absolutely. It's a program that's growing very quickly with women, pathways into womanhood. A slight difference because the journey for girls is different from boys. And so it's an inward journey for girls and more of an external journey for boys.
Mm. Well, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
Paul Henley is the National Training Manager of Pathways Foundation, and you can find a link to it on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. And while you're there, you can see photos and links to websites of our guests today, and also check out the transcript for last week's program on Goddess. I hope you're all enjoying the new look websites on Radio National. December 20th begins the Jewish Festival of Lights, Hanukkah. Next week, come with me and climb around the premier archaeological site in Jerusalem, the Palace of David, and also hear from two women who took 11 years to compile the world's most interesting Jewish cookbook, That's Stones and Soup, next week on The Spirit of Things, with me, Rachel Kahn.